the KEMRI CDC field research station in Kisumu. And I'd like to introduce the co-chair, Dr. Fabio Scano, who's at Stop TB WHO Geneva, but who is temporarily here in South Africa working with the Department of Health. So I'll turn it over to Fabio.
Good afternoon, everybody. Worldwide, the TB programs are making progress at offering HIV testing to TB patients, although a lot of work still needs to be done about it. But this symposium is a little bit about the other side of the equations, that it's basically offering TB screening to patients who will be identified HIV positive. Today, we will hear more about this from different settings and from different regions of the world.
Great, thanks. Well, we have a lot of speakers, and so we'd like to get started and hopefully have time for discussion. So I'd like to go ahead and call up our first speaker. Our first speaker was intended to be Dr. Chuan, who's the director of the revised National TB Program in India. Unfortunately, he was unable to be here with us, and on his behalf, Dr. Puneet Dhawan, who's a medical officer with WHO CRO, working with the TB program in India, is able to present on his behalf. Thank you, Puneet.
Good afternoon. On behalf of Dr. Chauhan, I'm pleased to present the experience of India in scaling up intensified TB case finding in voluntary HIV counseling and testing centers. Now, this is not research. This is a story of nationwide scale-up in a big place. Very briefly about India. India is the highest TB burden country in the world, with approximately 1.8 million TB cases estimated per year in 2005. DOTS expansion was only recently completed in 2006. India is also the world's third highest HIV burden country in terms of absolute numbers, with an estimated 2.46 million persons living with HIV/AIDS in 2006. However, given the 1.15 billion population, that translates to 0.36% of the adult population. However, there is a higher HIV prevalence in the southern states and also the northeast, where the adult prevalence, seroprevalence, is approximately up to 1%. Over the last few years, India has experienced a very rapid expansion of its voluntary counseling and testing, or VCT, center network. You can see in the figure on the right there, since 2004, there were less than 1,000 VCTs in India in the public sector. And in 2006, more than 4,000. So it's been a dramatic expansion in availability of counseling and testing services. Now, these VCT centers are not standalone. They're located within the health facilities. And often, in fact, there may be TB services available within the health facilities as well. At these VCT centers, trained counselors conduct pre- and post-test HIV counseling, as well as follow-up counseling for positives. We have to ask ourselves, why would we want to do intensified TB case finding in VCT centers as a matter of national policy? The first is that VCT clients have a higher HIV prevalence than the general population. In fact, the median HIV prevalence at VCT centers in 2006 was 10.8%. That's almost 30 times that in the general population. The second is that VCT center intensified case finding at VCTs could possibly detect TB cases earlier than through passive case finding. If that's true, that would result in reduced transmission, reduced morbidity and mortality, particularly among HIV-infected persons, and improved health facility infection control. It's also possible that intensified case finding could enhance TB case detection by detecting persons who may have otherwise either died or perhaps been diagnosed and or treated in the private sector outside of the national programs. Now, there's a history of intensified case finding in VCTs in India. In 2003, a pilot was done in five centers across four districts in the state of Maharashtra. There, a simple symptom-based screening tool was developed, as well as referral mechanisms, as well as in the operational parts, such as training and recording and reporting. And on the basis of this pilot, it was adopted by the national programs, TB and HIV programs, for scale-up in the VCT network in 2005. Very briefly, the training has been very important. The specific modules developed for counselors and medical officers shown here were an important part of it, but developing the modules was really the easiest part. The hard part for India has been getting the training done, and that's been facilitated by making local TV program managers responsible for the training of all the staff involved in this activity, and that includes the HIV program staff. Why is that? It's probably because they have the district-level program management capacity to conduct training. And they also monitor the training, and that monitoring is fed back to the national TB program so we can assess the completion of the activity. The training has really been facilitated by the existence of state TB-HIV coordination committees, where the TB program, the HIV program, and other decision makers, such as the health officer in charge of the facility, sits at the state level, and also the presence of some external technical assistance in the form of TB-HIV consultants from WHO or from GFATM supported, who have facilitated the logistics and the training activities and the monitoring and evaluation. They've been very important. However, the number of external consultants here is less than 10 for a population of over a third of a billion. So it's been a modest amount of external technical support, but it's been critical. How does ICF work in India? It's very simply driven by the counselors. A counselor is expected to ask all VCT clients about symptoms related to TB during pretest counseling and also follow-up counseling sessions. So each encounter is an opportunity for intensified case finding. Now, what symptoms do they ask for? Well, they ask primarily the main symptom the TB program asks, which is a cough of more than 3 weeks. However, that's not all that's in the training module. Also fever, weight loss, night sweats, unexplained swelling in the neck and axilla. Any of those symptoms can prompt someone to be a TB suspect. If a patient is a suspect with symptoms, they're referred to a microscopy center, which, again, is not a standalone facility. It's often within the same health center, with a routine sputum referral form that's widely available and used throughout the entire health system and, in fact, by other sectors as well. So the important point here is that there are no new screening forms. There are no new referral forms. This uses the existing infrastructure. There is some monitoring that's done, however. A counselor records referral on a line list shown here in the upper right. Those referrals at the end of the month are given to the TB program staff who check the TB program records, the laboratory register, the TB register, and they see if that patient has been completed their referral, been evaluated, been diagnosed with TB, and started treatment. That information is then given back to the counselor who compiles that onto a monthly HIV, VCT, TB-HIV report. Now, that report, importantly, this is complicated because the HIV status of the client referred is not given to the TB program. That HIV status is only known to the counselor, who then stratifies the data by HIV status when they produce their overall final report. For this evaluation, we compiled these monthly reports from 2,413 VCT centers over a 1.5-year period, January 2006 to June 2007. This data was restricted to the six states with the highest HIV prevalence, shown here in red. Now, this is a population of over 350 million persons. So it's about one-third of the country. However, these six states hold two-thirds of India's HIV burden. In a parallel evaluation, we also compiled records from 351 antenatal HIV testing centers, that is PMTCT centers in the state of Andhra Pradesh and also Mumbai, over a three-month period of time to ask a parallel question: what's the yield of intensified case finding in the PMTC population? Now, this slide shows the number of VCTs that have been reporting on TB intensified case finding. Now, the bottom, the x-axis, shows the time period here, broken up into three-month quarters, as I'll call them. The yellow bars show the number of VCTs, which, as you can see, has been increasing quite dramatically over this 1.5-year time period. However, more importantly, the red line shows the percent of all VCTs that are actually reporting on TB-HIV intensified case-finding activities. That percent has increased from 55% in the first quarter of 2006 to 74% in the most recent quarter, second quarter 2007. I needed to give you a sense of scale of training. This has been a massive undertaking of the program. Over almost 20,000 medical officers have been trained using these one-day TB-HIV modules, in addition to the regular TB program training activities, which are quite intensive. An additional more than 3,300 VCT counselors have been trained on the activity, as well as more than 2,000 TB program staff. The important, this does not reflect, this is a cumulative number, and because of turnover, this just does not reflect the number of trained staff, staff trained and in place at a given point in time. However, I think an important take-home is that a minor alteration in the algorithm, I mean, this is like an oil tanker, it can't turn very easily. And so a minor alteration of the algorithm driven by external advice or is not something that the program is really interested in doing. This graph shows the referral of VCT clients for TB screening over the same 1.5-year time period. The number of referred is shown here by the yellow boxes. And as you can see, the number of referrals has also climbed steadily along with the expansion of the activity over the 1.5-year time period. Importantly, the percent of clients, which is the red line, percent of all VCT clients referred, has been stable for most of this time at between 3 and 3.5% of all VCT clients, except for second quarter 2007, where suddenly we saw a jump to nearly 5%. Now, this was a very unexpected observation, and we sought to explore this a little further. This box plot shows the percent of VCT clients who were referred by this population of VCT centers as TB suspects. Now, the bottom box plot is first quarter 2007. So among 2,235 VCT centers reporting at that time period, the median was 3.1% of clients referred. That is, at least 50% of VCT centers referred for TB suspect evaluation, at least 1 in 33 of their clients. Okay. Now, second quarter 2007, you can see there that the median was 5.4%. So that is, at least half of the VCT centers are now referring at least 1 in 20 of clients for TB screening. It's a dramatic change in actual practice across this population of VCT centers. Now, this was interesting because it coincided with efforts by the program to try and intensify supervision and monitoring of the intensified case-finding activity. That is, there was a tension during program reviews with both the HIV program leadership and the TB program leadership to try and hold states and local centers accountable for their performance in terms of referral of VCT clients for TB screening. When we stratify the referrals by HIV status in the same time period, you can see that there were over 800,000 HIV-positive client encounters referred. I say client encounters because among the HIV-positives, a certain number of clients return for follow-up counseling after some time. And so that doesn't represent unique persons. But we can say among client encounters, 5% of those were referred among HIV positives. And that represents a minimum estimate because the number of unique persons here will be less than the number of encounters. Okay, so that's significantly greater than that we saw for HIV negative persons. Among HIV negative clients, among 2.3 million client encounters, and most of those are unique persons, there have been over 62,000 referrals, which is about 2.7%. So while proportionately more HIV positive clients have been referred, it's also interesting to note that more than 1.5 times the number of referrals have actually come among HIV negative clients. So in a sense, the activity is really reaching not just the HIV positive, but the HIV negative as well. In fact, most a greater proportion of the referrals are coming from the negatives. Now, this figure shows the outcomes of those VCT clients who were referred for TB screening over this 1.5-year time period. These are cumulative numbers. So of the more than 105,000 persons referred for TB screening, over 80,000, approximately 76%, reached the microscopy center. 22,000, or 21% of the referred, were diagnosed with active TB. And 18,000, we could document, were put on to TB treatment under the program, that is, started DOTS. That represents 17% of the overall referred group. But there are really three interesting observations from this slide. The first is that we're losing between about 1 in 4 clients before they ever reach the microscopy center. And as I mentioned, that's often in the same place. The reasons for this are not understood and are under evaluation. However, one observation has been patients often go for HIV testing quite far away from their homes to the other side of the district or even a different district or a different state and to avoid HIV-associated stigma. So it's possible that those persons may have been referred for TB testing and TB evaluation at their home place. The second observation is that 21% of those referred were diagnosed with active TB. And from a TB program perspective, that's an incredibly efficient source of case finding, when one in five of those referred that you evaluate are found to have active disease. The third is that of those 22,000 persons who were diagnosed with active TB, about one in five were lost between the time they were diagnosed and were not put on DOTS. And that's an interesting number that we're struggling with and trying to reduce. We can see that over time, the proportion of clients who are diagnosed with active TB, shown here by the yellow line, has remained relatively stable. That's actually very important to note, because I showed you earlier that we had a sharp increase in the proportion of clients referred in second quarter 2007. So despite that sharp increase in clients, proportion of VCT clients referred for TB screening, the proportion who are diagnosed with active TB has actually remained unchanged. So this again strengthens our interpretation that the rise in clients referred represents an actual improvement in both the quantity and the effectiveness of intensified case finding at the population of VCTs. The other interesting observation from this slide comes from the gap between the yellow line and the red line. The difference between those diagnosed with TB and those put on DOTS has essentially not really narrowed over this period of time, and that's a source of ongoing efforts from the program. It is important to recognize that that gap represents about 1,000 TB patients per quarter. And in the context of India's 300,000 TB patients notified and put on treatment per quarter, that's not a huge proportion. Nevertheless, it remains a target population and a point for program improvement. When we stratify these outcomes by HIV status, in terms of absolute numbers, you can see that a greater proportion of the referrals came from HIV negatives. Also, more of the active TB that was diagnosed also came from the HIV negative population of clients at the VCT centers. When we look at the numbers behind the graph I just showed you, you can see that almost twice as many of the diagnosed TB patients from this activity of intensified case finding came from the HIV negative client population as opposed to the HIV positive client population. In fact, when we look at the yield of case finding among the referred group, we can see that there was actually a slightly significantly higher proportion of referred HIV negative clients were diagnosed with TB, 23%, as compared to HIV positive clients. We found that very interesting and can't fully explain why. It remains possible that the bar is a little bit lower for referral among the HIV positive clients, as perhaps it should appropriately be so. And hence, we see a relatively similar yield among both groups. One of our big take-homes from this, however, has been that the activity of intensified case finding is equally useful in both the HIV negatives and the HIV positives. That is, it's an important source of case finding for the program. And when we look at the number of cases that the program has found from the intensified case finding activity in these six states, you can see that it was relatively flat for the first four quarters here, for all of 2006, but in 2007 has really taken off. But what does that mean for the program? For the program, we have to look at it as a proportion of overall case notifications. This is the contribution of intensified case-finding activities from the VCT centers to the overall case notification rate. So that's shown here in the yellow line above. It's been stable. This is total TB cases, that is, now. It's been stable about 130 per 100,000 population. That's annualized over this 1.5-year time period. Now, however, you can see in the red line there that the proportion of TB notifications that can be accounted by these VCT referrals has increased from just 1.9% in the first quarter of 2006 to 4.7% in the second quarter of 2007. So now about 1 in 20 notified TB cases in the six states that I've mentioned come from intensified case-finding activities at VCT centers. Now, we haven't seen a change in the overall notification rate, so it's not clear if this is supplemental case-finding or merely an alternate and perhaps earlier way to find the same cases who would have subsequently presented later. Nevertheless, we consider that a very encouraging sign of the effectiveness of the activity, and quite frankly, the program's happy to detect cases in any setting, whether it be the VCT center or the outpatient department or via partners. There are a number of challenges that have arisen as this activity has been scaled up. The first is ensuring that it continues to happen. As I mentioned before, there's been a modest amount of external technical assistance. This is done by the programs. And it takes quite a bit of supervision and monitoring to ensure that counselors continue to do the activity and that and continue to report on the activity as they are asked to do. And that is an ongoing added burden to the program. This is largely done by the TB program looking after the activity at the VCT centers. We have to find a way to reduce the recording and reporting burden on field staff. A lot of the data I presented to you has been very important for us to understand the activity, but it's not all necessary to monitor and supervise the activity. So we have to reduce the data to what's essential to see that it keeps happening. We have to also work with the HIV program to try and monitor the quality and the validity of the VCT reports. There's not a lot of quality. They're outside of the TB program's quality check system for the quality of reporting data. And interpreting results has been a challenge because there are no targets. We don't know how much TB to expect in VCT, and we don't want to set targets. We're actually trying to discourage that. However, the emphasis instead is on process and trying to focus on the processes of referrals and seeing that referrals continue to increase of VCT clients while monitoring the proportion who are diagnosed with active TB and seeing at what point that might saturate, where we might begin to see a reduction in the proportion diagnosed with active TB. And that might tell us when the referrals are pretty much where they need to be. No problem. I'll close up soon. I have to mention that among the antenatal clinic population, among 200,000 women screened in the sites I mentioned, there's been a very low yield of TB cases. Only 0.4% were referred as TB suspects, and only 95 were referred as diagnosed as TB cases, which is 0.5%. The implication of this, this has been taken by the program as evidence that there's just a very low yield of intensified case finding in India's antenatal HIV testing population. And as a result of this, that activity is not being scaled up with the expansion of the PMTC activities. So, in summary, intensified case finding at VCT centers is feasible on a large nationwide scale. And enablers of this success were TB program taking responsibility for the training, collaboration with the HIV program in terms of resources for training as well as the activity, as also their support to enable the activity to happen, and small but crucial catalytic external technical support in the form of those few consultants to help see that the activity happens. We also found more TB among HIV-negative than HIV-positive VCT client referrals. Now, we don't fully understand why, but the emphasis here is that the activity is important beyond the HIV-positive population. It's an important contribution to the TB program. And we've seen positive evidence that the contribution of the VCT centers to TB notification is increasing. And we found no evidence for extending this to antenatal screening. So India is now scaling up nationwide, implementing this in ART centers and collaborating with HIV NGOs to deliver intensified case finding to other high HIV prevalence populations, such as sex workers. And they're working to simplify the recording and reporting system. We have to acknowledge the National AIDS Control Organization and all of the implementing program staff, which number in the thousands, who did the job, as well as the consultants mentioned who were so crucial to helping collect the information. Thank you.
Puneet, thank you for this excellent overview of the efforts on ICF in India. We have time for one or two questions from the audience. I open the floor. Please, we will take two questions only, and then if you have time at the end, we will take more, please.
With regard to the HIV-negative patients and the high proportion that turned out to be TB-positive, when they presented to the VCT screening centers, did you ask them for a risk of exposure to HIV-positive patients, or did you find a higher prevalence of people just coming in with fever and being concerned they could be HIV-infected, but actually they had TB? So you are selecting, you know, a high-risk group, but based on clinical symptoms, not on risk for HIV exposure.
Puneet, can you just, sure. We take the second question, and you can answer both.
I'm Gary Clacquin from URC Lesotho. I understand that you have diagnosed the sputum smear positive TB patients only.
That's not true. That's actually entirely wrong. There are 400,000 patients in India treated with smear negative TB last year. So I'll be happy to show you the stratifications. So to answer the first question, this is activity. I can't comment on the micro detail at the facility level because this is really a collection of routine program data, but the activity extends to the entire population of persons who are attending the VCT center for whatever reason, whether they self-select because they're ill and they think HIV before they think TB, or because of they are concerned about risk behavior for HIV, or because someone's referred them for an HIV test because they have a clinical sign or symptom. For whatever reason they got to the VCT center, it's been an important avenue for the TB program to access to identify those cases. For the second point, I will mention that that about 60% of the TB diagnosed among HIV-positive clients through this mechanism were smear-positive, another 30% were smear-negative, another 10% were extrapulmonary. So the diagnosis is done via the International Standards of TB Care standard diagnostic algorithm. So patients have, if they're not smear-positive, they're still TB suspects and are asked to go through the diagnostic algorithm and determine if they would benefit from TB treatment.
Thank you, Dewan. I'd like to remind the speaker to stick to the time allocated. This is not because we want to finish by 4 o'clock, but because we want to allow enough time for discussion that is a crucial component also of this symposium. Now it's a great honor that I'd like to introduce the next speaker. Thank you. It was Dr. Michael Kimmerly, who will be talking about the ICF experience in Cambodia. Dr. Michael Kimmerly from University of Alabama and also the director of GORGOS, and he's been working on and off in Cambodia for the last 10 years. Please, Michael.
Thank you very much, Fabio. It's a pleasure to be here, and hello to everybody. So I'm going to talk about active case finding, focusing on the activities in the northwestern region of the country, but I want us to see the lessons that we learned earlier and why we progressed the way we progressed. So first of all, I'd like to thank my collaborators from UAB, from the Battambang Provincial Health Department, Institute Pasteur in Phnom Penh, where all of our microscopy and culture work is done, FHI, in which we collaborate closely, and funding from USAID. So there's three basic topics I'd like to address. First, what are the results of active case finding in our experiences? Second, what is our evaluation of the assessment of the symptom screen? Is assessment of cough enough or adequate? And finally, I'd like to introduce you just a little bit to our early analysis on predictors of smear-negative pulmonary TB, which is based on the same approach that we take for determining all TB cases. Briefly, it's estimated that about two-thirds of the population of Cambodia has a TB infection, latent TB infection. And during the time of the initiation of these activities in Cambodia, it was estimated that the HIV prevalence in persons aged 15 to 49 was about 1.9%, based on a Cambodian population of about 11.5 million. So phase one of our work in terms of active case finding and intensified case finding and screening began in Phnom Penh in 2000. This is prior to any formalized collaborative TB-HIV activities. So the goal was very simple, which was to expand TB care to HIV-infected persons. And the outcome we focused on and I'll discuss today was first what is the magnitude of TB in the HIV-infected population. At this point in time, there was only a home care population with clearly identified HIV-positive persons that you could access. We wanted to also evaluate utility of symptoms in the diagnosis, and I don't present this data today, but we did an assessment of mortality as well. So the home care population in 2000, there were about 785 persons registered. We checked the list, and we screened everyone who was confirmed HIV positive greater than 15 years of age. Our technique was a simple spot sputum done during a routine home visit, and we sent the samples for culture, DST, and speciation at Institute Pasteur in Phnom Penh. We had a large proportion that we could not survey for the various reasons here, just to mention that this is a highly mobile population. There was a high rate of death between the time that we checked the the registers and actually did our survey, it was about only a 2 to 3 month delay, but there was a high mortality in this very short period of time. So the burden of pulmonary TB that we found at the time of this initial screening was the bottom number. You can see that some persons were already diagnosed and on TB treatment, but we found a much higher proportion who were not on treatment at all. So about 9% of the surveyed population had undetected pulmonary TB. And I don't want to go through this in detail. The point of this slide here is to point out that at this point in time in 2000, we recognized that there was a significant burden of MOT, or mycobacteria other than TB, that we had to think about this seriously. And as you can see, of the 19 NTMs that we diagnosed, 16 out of the 19 were among the smear-negative persons that were assessed. So in our evaluation of symptoms, I've put cough more than 21 days as the top symptom because this is the basic screening test that we all use and are encouraged to use for pulmonary TB. And you can see it had a sensitivity of 65% in this population. And the highlighted areas in yellow, so rapid weight loss was more sensitive than cough, and then fever even more sensitive if you looked at the single symptom in terms of determining pulmonary TB. And any symptom, and here it's any symptom on the list, if we said this or that, then we could detect or have a sensitivity of 95%. And, of course, you can see the specificity suffers as you increase the number of symptoms that you add to the list. So the conclusions at this phase in our work was, first of all, that an HIV-positive patient or client should be considered as a TB suspect in this context, in this setting, and active disease ruled out as early as possible through some sort of intensified or active case-finding strategy. Secondly, we determined at this point in time that cough was not alone as a screening as a single screening symptom. Also, we learned that MOT, or M-O-T-T, is a common diagnosis among the smear negatives. And at this point in time, we started seriously considering a strategy for isoniazid preventive therapy. So phase two was in Battambang, the northwest region of the country, began in 2003. And here the goal was, okay, how do we or where do we introduce this intensified case finding? So the setting we chose, just like we heard from the previous speaker in India, was at the VCT, voluntary counseling, confidential counseling and testing centers. And here we determined this was the most likely point of entry for our HIV-positive clients because there were very few centers at that time, usually only one or two at the most in a district or a region. The study population that we investigated this phase was we were investigating for pulmonary TB among all clients visiting the predominant VCT center in this district of approximately 400,000 persons. Here we took everyone greater than 19 years of age who had been confirmed by rapid testing on two occasions. This is the basic structure, the time that we set up this study. So you can see the kind of classical structure where you have a VCT center as an entry point into HIV care, and you have a TB clinic as an entry point into TB care. So our goal was to link these two systems, and that's why we focused on doing our TB screening within the VCT center. Basic methodology is we collected three samples at this time, not a single spot specimen. We did a symptoms assessment, and again, we used Institut Pasteur in Phnom Penh to do our microscopy using fluorescent microscopy, LJ culture, and then ID. The case definition for this study was two positive smears or one positive culture. So we're using the older WHO definition in terms of having two smears. But I'll be able to show you the data on one as well. All patients were treated and were referred and treated. So the results I'd like to present in this algorithm is just the top area on the left side in the yellow. So we found pulmonary TB among 6% of all VCT clients. We found culture positivity slightly higher. Again, we found MOTT being predominantly among our smear negative. Pulmonary TB among the HIV-positive clientele was 16%, and pulmonary TB among those who tested negative for HIV was 2.4%. And here we found a statistical difference. Again, we looked at study characteristics. The median CD4 count in CD4 is only done on HIV positives in this setting, so you had a very low CD4 count in those with pulmonary TB. And looking at the symptoms below, again, cough greater than 3 weeks, as you notice on the list. With the exception of hemoptysis, cough greater than 3 weeks is the least sensitive symptom for pulmonary TB. Again, fever and rapid weight loss is very important. So here, our conclusions were that just look at the yellow highlights. The symptom complex, so we played around with our symptoms here. And here, the symptom complex, so we said, okay, what happens if you don't even ask about cough? So here we said fever or hemoptysis or rapid weight loss. We had a sensitivity of 100%, and it was no different between the HIV positive and the HIV negative. And at the bottom, you can see the accuracy of symptoms in general was lower among the HIV positive than the HIV negative. And I just want to highlight the main points. There's a lot more detailed analysis in a pending publication. When we looked at the predictors for pulmonary TB, you can see that age greater than 35, a low BMI, of course, HIV positive status, and a history of rapid weight loss were significant indicators for pulmonary TB in the overall VCT client population. And cough greater than 3 weeks did not stay in the model. So here's the yield of sputum microscopy and culture by the number of samples that were done. So we took culture confirmed TB, or culture confirmation is the gold standard, again by LJ. That's the top bar lines, and we have that with HIV-associated TB, and the orange and the blue represents all pulmonary TB. So I take you to the very bottom set of bars. It says at least two sputum smear positive. This was the 2000, you could say prior to 2007 WHO case definition. And here you can see that more than half of the patients would be diagnosed just based on two smear examinations. All right, two out of three being positive. If you look at any of the first two being diagnostic, you can see there was a very significant yield. That's the second set of bars from below. If you look first culture positive, it's nearly 85%. So if your strategy were to collect two samples, send the first for culture, and base it on that, you would detect 85%. And then if you said just above it, at least two sputum smear positive or first culture positive, you could detect 95%. So the conclusions and recommendations from this phase of our program development and evaluation was that VCT is a very important entry point for detection of undiagnosed pulmonary TB, that it is feasible in rural areas and at the district level, that a single sputum culture increases detection significantly, but is importantly not a replacement for sputum microscopy. The symptom combination or choice of fever or hemoptysis or weight loss identified all of our TB cases regardless of their HIV status. And it's been brought up in the prior lecture that we obviously have a very mixed population accessing this clinic. We did a prior survey of people just looking at symptoms, and people are coming to this clinic or these clinics because they're sick. They're symptomatic. They think they perhaps have HIV and have TB, but we haven't evaluated that in a separate study. And again, the issue of IPT is very important to consider. So the next phase of the program, and I have to say that this region, Batambongo, is one of four pilot areas under the Ministry of Health's Continuum of Care package for HIV. So it's a collaboration between the TB and the HIV services. So the next step is then to say, okay, let's actually put our screening program processes into the ART clinic or the HIV clinic. So here we open what's called the IPT clinic. And the goal of this IPT clinic is to screen every newly registered HIV positive person who's coming into the clinic with the ultimate goal of screening out TB and putting them on IPT. I don't present the data on IPT here. So these are the results of the general reporting or the general screening since September 2003. Through June 2007, and here it's being done in two districts. The first column, BTB, is Battambang. It's a larger, more urban district. MRS is a very rural district without any physicians working there, only medical assistants. So overall, you can see the number of HIV testing done. The percent positive is around 20%. It's 18% overall. The referral for screening is superb. The capture is excellent. As you can see, those who are diagnosed with HIV-positive disease, almost all of them are screened. In fact, they're all referred, and in fact, the number 4,300 more screened because people are starting to send people to these centers for screening from other VCT centers, even outside the district. So that's why our screening numbers actually exceed the number of HIV determined in the center. All right, active TB cases, 24% overall determined. And here, not everyone is culture confirmed, so this data is a little bit different cohort I'm talking about, but you can see it's a very high proportion that are found to have TB, 24%, and it's divided between smear positive, smear negative, and extrapulmonary. So then we decided just to focus looking at the cohort of patients who come from the Battambang district between November 04 and May 06 because this is where we had our cleanest culture data. And again, looking at the issue of symptoms with regard to pulmonary TB status. So fever greater than 1 month, the sensitivity is 77%. Cough greater than 3 weeks, only 45%. And the combination of fever or cough or hemoptysis, 84%. That combination. So then when we look at smear negative and we look at some of the other characteristics, so we have symptoms and we have x-ray and age, you can see all of those were significant in the final model. So older age was a significant variable. The presence of symptoms, and the symptoms are listed below. Again, here it's cough greater than 3 weeks or hemoptysis or fever is significant. And here the x-ray, I just want to mention in passing that it depended on where the X-ray was read, whether or not it predicted smear-negative pulmonary TB. There can be a lot of bias in on-site reading. So in summary, if we look at the three phases of our work in Cambodia and the relationship of cough in relation to other symptoms, you can see that cough greater than 3 weeks as a single item is not the most sensitive approach, and that's we found in HIV-positive home care populations. We found it in VCT population among both HIV-positive and negative, and then we found it even when we focused on the smear-negative pulmonary TB group. Let's see. And if you look at the middle column where it says call for fever or weight loss, the phase 2 VCT study, you can see that among HIV positive, this symptom complex was more significant or was significantly more present than if you looked at the HIV negative population. So the symptoms do work differently depending on which group you're using them in. In conclusion, we said that in high prevalence settings, all HIV positive patients should be considered TB suspects and disease ruled out by active screening methods. Cough alone, and here I mean cough greater than 3 weeks, is not the most sensitive symptom among HIV-infected persons, patients, including those with smear-negative pulmonary TB, and is therefore not a sufficient symptom screen. MOTT is common among all, or particularly common among the smear-negative patients. And active case finding can be implemented at the district level with access to culture facilities and at costs that are modest. I don't present the cost here, but there was a poster this morning in which we presented our cost data. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Michael, for a very comprehensive evaluation. We'd like to take about two questions. Are there any questions out there?
First, thanks for an excellent presentation. I had a couple of questions on how you define the symptoms, because I think one thing we're finding is that you get different results. And I wanted to know about when you say rapid weight loss, how that was defined, and also whether you looked at any cough, because I think some people have been finding that if you wait until they have a cough greater than 3 weeks, that's different than asking about any cough.
So these are, first of all self-reported symptoms, and rapid weight loss means that you notice the weight loss, and it's usually defined as within the last month, a significant amount of weight loss. But, of course, we do measure BMI, but we don't have any pre- or post-measurements, so we can't define what rapid means. It's really the terminology that was decided locally, considering their local appreciation of symptoms, to call it rapid weight loss. So it's how it got translated. Basically, okay? And The second question was about cough. Yeah. On the forms, again, this is, in a way, this is a lot of this is programmatic data. So we introduced this IPT program. We decided we have a one-page form for screening people in, and so we don't ask the question first, any cough. We go straight to the what's used at the national level and for national standards, which is cough greater than 3 weeks. So we don't have that distinction. But I think Kevin, in the next talk, will be able to answer that more directly, and it's done in the same site. So that's what we know.
Thanks, Michael. Are there any other questions? Bess, yes.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for that wonderful presentation. I was wondering, with the identification of the MOTS, if you thought you are just culturing colonizers, or if you think this was true disease, because, I mean, I'm working as an infectious disease attending in New York City, and we culture this all the time, but the patients are smear negative, and there is a tiny fraction that really meets the clinical criteria for the diagnosis of disease, active disease due to MOTS.
Sure. I've thought about this, but we haven't really done the analysis of this because we don't have multiple specimens. And, you know, to make a definition of MOT and to treat it, the guidelines say multiple specimens on multiple occasions, and then the clinical and the X-ray findings. So we're not diagnosing it or trying to distinguish it as a colonizing infection versus disease. But I could go back, look at the data, and I could predict probably 70% of these people have symptoms that I'm sure about, and more than half of them or around half will have an abnormal, will have some kind of abnormality on X-ray. But whether that's MOT, I'm not sure.
Thanks. I'll just take one more. Beth?
Yeah, Mike, excellent presentation. I just wanted to find out a little bit about the burden on the laboratory as we increase the sensitivity and order a lot of smears by decreasing the specificity. How did the lab manage with that?
Right. So for all of this work, we were very lucky to have in-country lab capacity at the Institut Pasteur. And at the time that we initiated this work, there were no other really researchers in the country interested in the lab. They were using it for clinical, so we didn't have a problem. But now there is a problem because there are multiple other research projects demanding use of the lab. But at the time that up for the data that I showed you through until about April 2006, we had no problems with lab capacity, and they have really only one incubator. I mean, it's not a large lab with a large TB division. But now what's happened is the regional lab where all this work is being done has now been developed into a culture facility. So we could easily, once the EQA is done, and some of this has been done, we could easily do this work using the local lab in terms of culture and smear. We would lose our fluorescent microscopy, but we would still have our culture capacity. So I think it's doable, at least in this region.
Great. Thank you. Well, I think that's all we have time for. Thank you very much. Before I introduce the next speaker, just to let you know, there are some people standing in the back, and there are actually quite a number of seats down front, so feel free to come down. I'd like to introduce the next speaker, Dr. Kevin Kane, who's a medical epidemiologist in the Division of TB Elimination at CDC, who's been working for a number of years closely with the national TB programs in Cambodia and in Thailand. And he'll continue this theme of the last talk, looking at clinical algorithms to diagnose TB in HIV-infected persons.
Thanks, Kayla. Thanks, everyone, for coming to listen to this important topic that's being discussed in today's symposium. Today I'll be presenting about developing a clinical algorithm to diagnose TB in HIV-infected persons in Asia. First, let's talk about why we need sensitive screening to begin with. The case fatality rate for HIV-infected TB patients in Asia is extremely high, between 25 and 50% during the 6 months of TB treatment. About half of these deaths occur within the first 2 months of TB treatment. Early diagnosis should decrease this case fatality. In addition, it should improve the safety of ART initiation and should improve the uptake of isoniazid preventive therapy. Finally, because of these reasons, it is a WHO recommendation to do TB screening on a regular basis for all HIV-infected persons. However, screening HIV-infected persons for TB is difficult. HIV-infected TB patients often lack classic TB symptoms. Up to 30% of them with pulmonary TB can have a normal chest radiograph, and sputum smears can be negative in 50% or more. While some evidence has been collected on this that has given us a good start as to directions that we might go, there is no evidence-based approach to TB screening which has yet been globally adopted. The limitations of previous studies include some which were single-center studies, some which included pre-screened patients or patients who would already be defined as TB suspects because they met some criteria, for example, chronic cough. Some looked at only referral patients or patients who were hospitalized, and finally, some did not include a gold standard workup for TB using just blood culture in some or a variety of other techniques. It was with that in mind that we, in collaboration with a large number of other individuals and partners, including the previous speaker, Michael Kimmerling, developed a research study to develop an evidence-based clinical algorithm to diagnose TB in HIV-infected persons. Our goal was to develop that algorithm based on all patients, meaning that we wanted to make no assumptions about the importance of cough or other symptoms prior to screening individuals. We wanted to use a sensitive combination of microbiological tests as our gold standard. The study population for this research included persons newly diagnosed with HIV infection at VCT sites, those with previous HIV diagnosis, newly presenting to the HIV clinic or a CD4 testing facility, and persons already enrolled in HIV care, some of whom were already on ART. The study eligibility criteria is as follows. First, documented HIV infection. All persons had to be at least 7 years of age. They had to be not currently being treated for tuberculosis and had to have no history of TB treatment or isoniazid preventive therapy within the previous year. They had to have not had TB screening defined as a chest radiograph or sputum smears within the preceding 3 months, and they had to have not consumed any medications with anti-TB activity, including fluoroquinolones, within the previous 1 month. Our enrollment sites, our goal is to enroll a total of 2,050 patients across 3 countries, including Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam. This includes 600 in one site in Bangkok, 1,000 in 4 sites in Cambodia, and 450 in 3 sites in Ho Chi Minh City. Our study procedures include first obtaining informed consent, then administering a questionnaire from the doctor or the nurse, which collects data on history of present illness, past medical history, and medications. The patient is then examined by the doctor, and a standardized physical exam is recorded. The patient gets a chest radiograph, has blood tests, which include a blood count and a CD4 test, and as our microbiologic gold standard, we do culture and smear of 3 sputum specimens, 1 urine specimen, 1 stool specimen, and 1 blood specimen. In addition, any patient with an enlarged peripheral lymph node has their lymph node aspirated and cultured. Optional tests are included in this study, and that includes a tuberculin skin test and HIV viral load testing. Those are only done at sites which were already doing that as part of their routine activities prior to the study. For our laboratory procedures, the US CDC assessed all participating laboratories and worked with them to develop standardized SOPs across all 3 countries. 1 reference laboratory in each country is participating in the study. All laboratories use LJ for solid culture, and in addition to solid culture, Vietnam and Thailand also use liquid culture. For our analysis, we define any patient with at least 1 positive culture identified as TB as having TB. We compare characteristics of patients with TB to those without TB, and use logistic regression and classification and regression tree analysis, which is essentially a form of decision analysis, to determine what factors are predictive of tuberculosis in this population. This slide shows our current enrollment as of 5 days ago. A total of 1,268 patients have been enrolled unevenly across the 3 sites. The reason for the uneven enrollment is that we started first in Thailand, then in Cambodia, and then started about 2 to 3 months ago in Vietnam. On the far right column, you'll see how many patients are included in this analysis. The reason these are so vastly different, of course, is that we had to wait 3 to 4 months to have all of the culture results available, entered, cleaned, and prepared for analysis. So included in this analysis are 541 of the ultimate 2,050 that are planned for this study. Because of this, I'm going to present some highlights of the results that we have thus far and highlight some features that we found particularly interesting. The final algorithm, which will be based on the 2,050 patients, will, of course, have to wait until the study is complete. These are the characteristics of patients enrolled thus far. 52% were female. The median age is 33. 2% were hospitalized at the time of enrollment. 29% were on antiretroviral therapy at enrollment, and the median CD4 cell count was 306. This slide shows the total number of patients thus far who were diagnosed with TB, meaning that they had one culture positive for TB. In Thailand, 10 of the 335 patients with complete culture results, or 3%, were diagnosed with TB. In Cambodia, it was 18 of 198, or 9%, bringing the total to 28 of 533, or 5%, thus far. A very interesting finding to us was the extremely high burden of NTM that we saw in this study. As you see, in Thailand, 83 of the 335 patients enrolled had at least one culture positive for non-tuberculous mycobacteria. That's 25% of the whole population. 27 of those, or 8%, had at least two cultures positive for NTM. In Cambodia, there was one patient with NTM, and it's notable, and I'll discuss this later, that Thailand does use liquid culture, whereas Cambodia does not, which can have a substantial impact on these results. One finding we would like to highlight is the fact that chronic cough seems to be a poor predictor of tuberculosis. In the first column with numbers are listed the 28 patients with culture-positive TB. As you can see, 20 of them, or 71%, reported any cough. 7, or only 25%, reported cough greater than 2 weeks. And 6, or just 21%, reported cough greater than 3 weeks. This makes the sensitivity for these three symptoms 71% for any cough, 25% for cough greater than 2 weeks, and 21% for cough greater than 3 weeks. Of note, the algorithm or the combination of symptoms listed at the bottom of that slide, patients defined as having any cough, any fever, or any weight loss, was 93% sensitive for TB. We did have a chance, actually, just during the break, to look at the symptoms that Michael had used in his analysis, cough, fever, and hemoptysis. We also found that that was 84% sensitive. And using the algorithm discussed in the noontime seminar, which included cough greater than 3 weeks, fever greater than 1 month, or BMI, which was low, we found a sensitivity of 64%. Other symptoms and signs were definitely associated with TB. I won't go through this whole list, but suffice it to say that elevated temperature, low BMI, lymphadenopathy, and some laboratory findings, in addition to an array of symptoms, were also significantly associated with TB. I'd like to discuss the impact of liquid media on the diagnosis of both TB and NTM. In the pinkish colored bars, this is stratified by smear-positive and smear-negative patients. So what you can see is that among smear-positive patients from Thailand, 4 patients had a positive culture on solid media for TB, and likewise, the same four patients had a positive culture on liquid media. This shouldn't be terribly surprising, as you would expect that most smear-positives would, in fact, be culture-positive. However, among smear-negatives, we find that only 3 were culture positive among using solid media, and 6 were culture positive using liquid media. So liquid media did enhance the sensitivity of tuberculosis in this example. For NTM, the finding is far more dramatic. Among smear positives, again, there wasn't a substantial difference. Three of the smear positives were also positive on solid media, and 5, so an additional 2, were positive for an NTM using liquid media. Among smear negatives, the sensitivity for NTM is dramatically increased when liquid media is used. Only 7 were identified with solid media compared to the 78 which were identified using liquid media. The last point I would like to make is the added yield of non-sputum specimen collection. Again, we had 28 patients who were culture positive for TB. 24 of them had a positive sputum culture on solid media, Three of the remaining four had a positive sputum culture on liquid media, leaving one patient who had only a positive blood culture. Interestingly, that patient was from Cambodia, and therefore liquid culture of the sputum was not performed, so we can't say whether he was positive using that. In conclusion, chronic cough is an insensitive predictor of tuberculosis. NTM is far more common than at least we expected. Liquid culture has increased sensitivity for TB among smear negatives and greatly increased sensitivity for NTM. And there's a possibility, and we won't know this for sure, but there's a possibility that if a site was trying to decide what additional laboratory capacity to build or what additional cultures to do in addition to solid culture of sputum, that actually adding liquid culture of sputum would be more important or higher yield than culturing non-sputum specimens. Again, I think that will have to wait until the study is completed, but that's what we're seeing so far. So our recommendations are as follows. First, we believe that the cough greater than 2 or 3 weeks should not be used as the entry point to algorithms, including the WHO algorithm, which seek to diagnose TB in smear-negative patients. Second, given the high burden of NTM, the use of identification techniques is essential when using liquid culture and when implementing liquid culture. And finally, similar studies should be done in sub-Saharan Africa, such that we can have data that are generalizable to other high burden settings. The next step for us are to complete study enrollment, which we expect to be approximately April of 2008, and then to analyze the data as we've described before to develop a more formal algorithm that will help us to try to find an evidence-based approach to diagnosing TB disease. I'd like to thank USAID for funding this study and thank the many other collaborators for their involvement. Thank you.
Kevin, thanks a lot for this great talk and also for the interesting recommendation. We now open the floor for two questions, and please can you introduce yourself if there is any question.
Fabio.
Yes.
David Cohn from Denver. Kevin, this is a great study. We await the full results. Have you identified the non-tuberculous mycobacteria, and if so, what are the species and their distribution or frequency?
That's a great question, and that's something we'll definitely be doing. We've started doing that. Initially, our plan was just to use biochemical techniques to identify TB versus non-tuberculous mycobacteria, but when we found this many NTMs, we decided to do HPLC in addition. We've speciated some of them and found not very many MAC, and we've found that the distribution of others, that there's a huge number of other NTMs that are involved. So we can't answer that quite yet, but we will be able to answer that once we have all the data. It's also, I think, notable that our laboratory staff who were working in the area went to great efforts to make sure that this wasn't a laboratory contaminant by culturing the water in the laboratory, culturing all of the culture media, all of the reagents and everything that was used, and found absolutely no NTMs there. So this appears to be a real finding, but the clinical significance remains to be seen.
Hello, my name is Kimberly McCarthy, and I worked with Dr. Kane for this study. I'd like to give a little bit more detail on the identification of the NTM. As Kevin just mentioned, we are finding several species of NTM, not as many Mycobacterium gordoni, but we're finding quite a bit of Mycobacterium chelone abscessus as well as Mycobacterium fertuitum complex. So we're still in the process of performing external quality assurance on all the HPLC patterns. But as Kevin mentioned, we went through great lengths to ensure that we would not introduce NTM into any patient specimens during our study, including the use of commercially prepared products as opposed to products that were prepared in the laboratory. We also purchased all media, performed QC of the water inside the laboratory, as Kevin just mentioned, as well as QC of the water in the actual collection site where the patients were rinsing their mouths.
Thanks, Kim. We were incredibly fortunate to have Kim as our laboratory consultant and expert for this study, and it made a tremendous difference.
I am Ziaur Rahim from Bangladesh. I'd like to ask the question, how often you collected the specimen from the patient for screening?
Okay, thank you.
Every 3 months, monthly or whatever?
Actually, this is a one-time collection. This is at the initial presentation. And basically what we do is on day one, when the patient comes, they go through the clinical evaluation, and we collect sputum specimen number one, and we also collect their blood and collect their urine. On the second day when they return, they bring sputum number two and then provide a spot sputum number three using the standard spot morning spot technique, and then also provide the stool specimen that they've collected overnight.
My second question is, say for example, if you have this patient and those are TB negative at this stage, maybe positive subsequently, then what should be the strategy of screening of these HIV patients? Quarterly or monthly or every 6 months?
That's actually the next critical question, we think. I think before you can answer the question of how often you should screen, you have to know how to screen. Because if you screen poorly the first time, then you're much more likely to find it the second time. We can't answer that question right now, although we do plan and hope to do follow-up studies once we have a working algorithm where we will be able to use the algorithm at point zero and then follow up over a regular interval to see how much TB is being found.
Thank you. Thank you, Kevin, so much.
Thanks.
Now we move on.
So now moving to another setting, we have Aniki Peters, who will be speaking on South Africa. It's a slightly different title than what is in your program. It's screening for TB among persons living with HIV/AIDS by home-based healthcare workers in South Africa. Aniki is a TB program consultant here in South Africa. Thank you. I think you just...
Okay.
Free advertising.
There's a little... Here we go. Oh, yes. Okay, thank you. Thank you. And now, this is actually not exactly the same that the previous people did. We are busy with a implementation of something very, very practical. We know that in South Africa we have a very high prevalence of HIV, the highest in the world, and we are fifth on the list of high burden TB countries. Now, basically what we have done is we implemented a screening card for TB amongst our home-based care workers in two sites in South Africa. Now, in our program, basically in any TB-HIV collaboration setting with HIV and TB, we must have specific practices like screening, TB screening practices. There must be a referral for TB diagnostics and referral for anti-TB treatment, coordination of anti-TB treatment and antiretroviral therapy, and documentation of TB indicators. Now, specifically in this study, we concentrated on TB screening practices, and then specifically under our home-based care voluntary workers. The study was done, we are busy with the study in two sites. Site A is basically a site only seeing HIV patients, and some of them on treat ARV and others not on ARV. And then they are referred to a multiple of local TB clinics in that specific area, and it's mainly urban. Our second site is Site B, and this is a comprehensive health facility where the TB clinic and the HIV clinics and a lot of it's a comprehensive service or a supermarket approach, as we call it in South Africa, and this is basically in a rural location. Now, what we have done is that we basically have our home-based care workers working in these sites, and they visit the people living with HIV who are waiting for ART and those that's already on ART. And in both of the sites, there's more people waiting to start ART than already on ART. And this study has also been done on evidence-based study being done in Malawi, where they found that patients that coughed for longer than 3 weeks and been screened by home-based carers, that 20% of them actually been diagnosed with TB after the screening. Now, the methods that we used, we focused on our staff, our home-based care workers, and our ARV adherence counselors. Those were basically the focus groups that we had. And then we developed a basic TB screening card and protocol to be implemented. We trained our home-based care workers at both sites and our ART adherence counselors on the basic signs and symptoms of TB and why it's so important to have an integrated approach on HIV-TB. Now, I just want to emphasize, remember, these people are voluntary workers and they had basic home-based care training. And this is an ongoing process, and we are evaluating the impact of the intervention. Now, what we have done is we set up a pretest, and they had to complete this, and then after that we did this training. It was a quite practical training on the level of their experience and their knowledge, and we actually wanted to expand their knowledge and their skills and to make them capable to screen for TB symptoms. After the training, it was very interesting. We had specific scenarios, and they had role play, and I really enjoyed it. And it was very, very interesting to see the results with the pre- and the post-test. Now, this is basically what happened. It was interesting to see that most of them knew about the signs and symptoms of TB. They knew that cough and fever and night sweats and weight loss and fatigue and all these symptoms may be present, but 62% of them actually said at the beginning there's no ways that there may be five symptoms, that one patient can have five symptoms. And after the training, it improved with 46%. And 53% of them said they are not confident to start doing screening. And then after the training, 78% said, yes, they do have the confidence to basically do it. Now, that was especially after we've done all the role play. Now, I just want to emphasize here, at this stage, we are supporting them on a very regular basis. And we are retraining them if there's a need. So the support system is ongoing, and there's definitely a system in place, so if they haven't got the confidence to go on, we are trying to equip them with that. Now, this is basically a preliminary results that I'm going to present. We haven't got all the results. What I can say is that we have basically collected most of the data, and we are busy entering it, but it's still an ongoing process. Now, we don't know at this stage what is the number of people living with HIV/AIDS receiving home-based care in the two sites. Then how many has been screened and how many has not been screened, but what we do know is that we basically only collected those at the beginning of the study where there's only two or more signs and symptoms of TB, but we realized that we must basically go on and we must collect all the data. Also those with less than two symptoms. We have started doing that, and at this stage we basically are screening all the contacts, all the suspects, and we have collected and are busy entering about 2,000 to 2,005 questionnaires at this time. Then from those 248, 55 of them were diagnosed with active TB, and specifically on sputum results and then clinical signs and symptoms and x-rays. And then TB was excluded by 78% of them at 193. Now, what we are busy doing now is we are busy to see the number of patients that's been screened, and or we must screen those that's not been screened, that we don't actually thought it was necessary to screen them. And we are also busy screening those with less than two symptoms, and we are going to do the basic follow-up with them, and then also those that's been excluded. So this is an ongoing process that at the end of the day, all the contacts and all the patients will be screened and follow-up, and this will be an ongoing thing. So if there's someone with a negative or with no signs and symptoms, they will follow it up, and we are following them up on a monthly basis. So it's not only one-off process. Now, the challenges at this stage is that for the home-based carers and the voluntary workers to basically adopt this new way of dealing with people living with AIDS, because some of them do see this as extra work, and, you know, I'm going to say again, we are working with voluntary workers, and it's basically a support system that must be in place. And we really have to give 110% support for them to go on with this and see the importance of the HIV-TB integration. Then a recording of TB screening data by the home-based care workers, the supervision and support for them, as I said, and then sensitivity and specificity of TB screening questions, because at this stage we are concentrating we have concentrated only on those with two or more symptoms. Now, the next steps, what we are busy doing now and going to implement, is we are busy screening all the other people within the homes, as all the people that's in contact or suspects. We are busy analyzing the data, and we are in the development of screening implementation material and recording and reporting forms. And then I just want to acknowledge the people that were involved in the study. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anekia. We have some time for questions. Is there any question from the audience? Please identify yourself.
Tom Wells. I'm working in Transkei part of South Africa with Xhosa people, and I'm just interested, it's touched on with an earlier question, but just interested in what actual language the community health workers are using when they're asking for these symptoms, because my experience often if I ask, people tend to answer yes to a lot of my questions, particularly, do you have night sweats? Yes, doctor. Do you have fever? Yes, doctor. And so I tend to ask questions like, how are you sleeping, or other sorts of questions to try and get it out. And I think it would make a big difference to the answers. The questions you ask make a big difference to the answers that you get. And I wonder what you were using.
Okay. What we have done is we were aware that they may say yes to all the questions. So it's basically that we've trained them to ask the question on a specific way. For example, with night sweats. We won't ask them, do you have night sweats? We will ask them, have you seen any changes within your sweating pattern? And then if they say, yes, they do have night sweats, then we'll say, how do you know that you have it? So we really, we've trained these people very intensively on the way that they are supposed to do the or ask the questions, and that's also why we've implemented in the training the role play to give them specific scenarios. You know, and we say to them if they are not 100% sure, then rather take it as a yes and overscreen than underscreen.
Thank you. Ken.
Thanks. I don't know if this is working. Thank you. I appreciate the presentation. One of the questions that came up in a session on infection control yesterday is what are we doing to protect these outreach workers? Is there anything that you can tell us that you're doing, whether it's in training or any practical advice to prevent them from getting infected with tuberculosis as they go out and see these persons?
Yes. The way we also in the basic training, we gave them the basic information on infection control. And in one of the sites, they specifically asked me to go and give them more information on cross-infection, as they call it, and on infection control. So we are, and this is, as I'm saying, it's an ongoing thing. So I am very, very aware of infection control, and especially for these people, and they do have very, very good questions because they are also very afraid. So on each session and each follow-up, we emphasize the importance of infection control.
We have time for one more question.
Thank you. I'm Blaise. I'm director of TB and HIV pediatric program in Partners in Health Rwanda. So thank you very much for your presentation about active finding of TB cases. And your presentation allow me to just to make a comment about two presentation. Because I asked myself the role or the place of cough in tuberculosis diagnostic, because there's someone from CDC who even recommended that the cough, chronic cough, should not appear in algorithm when you are thinking about tuberculosis. So as I used to work with children, so this is true in pediatric, but I can say that the HIV is changing a lot of patterns. I can say the classic patterns of tuberculosis, but we should always be aware of that because immunity is depressed, and this is why maybe there's no cough, yeah, and sometimes there's no fever. But if we say that we recommend in this international conference saying that, cough, chronic cough cannot be considered as the basic how to just make active case finding, I think that you are going to miss a lot of people. Just this is my comment because they presented about that, and I thought, I'm not conservative, but I think that HIV is changing a lot of things, but we should always be aware of the classic, not only symptoms, but also the chest X-ray is changing, but still we think and rule out. Thank you very much.
I can just say that we are aware, you know, out of the experience with these people, there's a lot of patients that will come and basically not report any cough, but they do have two or three of the other symptoms. And then eventually you can get, we do get sputums from them, and when you start trying asking the questions, they actually have a chronic cough and it's no problem for them because it's there. That's why it's so important to basically concentrate on all the signs and symptoms and not only on the cough. Remember, we are working with voluntary workers, and we basically had to give them the skills and the knowledge to be able to strengthen our TB program. Thank you.
Thank you, Neka. We will have some more time at the end of the symposium, maybe to address the question, and maybe Kevin would like to take this on. Now we move on to the next speaker. It's with great pleasure that I'd like to introduce you, Dr. Joseph Odhiambo. Dr. Joseph Odhiambo works with CDC GAP in Kenya, and he's a TB HIV guru, and he will talk about the implementation of infection control guidelines in Kenya. So we are one step ahead, and we're already talking about implementation. Thanks a lot, Joseph.
Well, thank you very much. First, allow me to thank the Congress organizers for inviting me to speak here today. In the next 10 minutes or so, I just want to share with you what Kenya is putting in place to make intensified case finding for TB among people living with HIV and AIDS an integral part of expanding TB-HIV services in Kenya. First, the context. Kenya is located in East Africa, south of Ethiopia, and has 33 million people. We estimate that 1.2 million Kenyans are HIV positive, but on the positive side, Kenya is making remarkable strides in reducing the burden of HIV. 7 years ago, the adult population had an HIV prevalence of 14%, but as of the moment, it is 6%. However, we have witnessed a six-fold rise in TB burden over the last 15 years, and at the end of last year, Kenya registered in excess of 115,000 TB cases. We estimate that 52% of TB cases in Kenya are co-infected with HIV. However, the prevalence and the incidence of TB in HIV care settings remain unknown. WHO, however, estimates that only about 50% of the TB cases in Kenya is detected. Now, the goal of collaborative TB-HIV activities in Kenya is to decrease the burdens of TB and HIV in dual affected persons. And since 2002, we have had a first involvement of these collaborative TB-HIV activities. And we have had several achievements. I just wanted to share with you a few. Collaborative TB-HIV activities is high in the national agenda. We have standard HIV testing guidelines which are currently being widely used and distributed. In excess of 70% of TB patients at this moment receive HIV counseling and testing. We expect that this should ultimately rise to universal HIV testing for all TB patients. 80% of our HIV-positive TB patients receive cotrimoxazole, and we estimate that about 30% are on ART. What are our next steps? In May of this year, Kenya held a TB-HIV stakeholders meeting, the goal of which was to plan the next phase of activities. The objectives were to prioritize activities to decrease the burden of TB among people living with HIV and AIDS, and to draft guidelines on intensified TB case finding, TB infection control in HIV care settings, and isoniazid preventive therapy. This stakeholders meeting put together the key TB and HIV players in Kenya. We also invited CDC Atlanta, and we were blessed to share the experiences of Botswana as well as South Africa with respect to IPT and infection control in HIV care settings, respectively. Now, the last objective of the stakeholders' meeting was to expand intensified case finding from pilot projects to full-scale implementation. What were the observations that we made at the stakeholders' meeting? that TB intensified case finding in Kenya is still suboptimal, and that intensified case finding, if this is suboptimal, introducing IPT could promote development of resistant TB screens. And thirdly, this is perhaps one of the reasons for lack of enthusiasm for wide-scale IPT. Now, intensified case finding is considered high priority for TB-HIV activities in the next phase. Now, I just want to acknowledge some of the studies that have been done to evaluate different tools for intensified case finding. I'm glad to meet a cross-section of my colleagues who are in the forefront of doing this, home-based care and gold mine in South Africa, and the VCT sites. We've just listened to a colleague from Addis Ababa, as well as colleagues from Cambodia. We have also had similar studies in HIV care settings in Uganda. What are the Kenya intensified case-finding guidelines and TB screening tools? We recognize that different providers use their own guidelines and tools in various pilot initiatives. Now, the TB and HIV program has put together a work group that has drafted the intensified case-finding guidelines and TB screening tools. We, however, need to evaluate and validate these tools. For example, one of our partners, ICAP, coordinated by Columbia University, who are operating the central part of Kenya, use this symptom screening algorithm, and that in over 3 months, July to September this year, they screened in excess of 2,800 patients that were enrolled in their HIV care clinics. 46 of these, or 1,325, were screened for TB. Of these, 115, or 4%, were positive based on the symptom screen, and 92% of these, or 106 patients, were diagnosed with active TB. Now, the guideline that has been presented to the TB program from the stakeholders meeting has several elements that consist of all this. And in the next phase, we want to find out what is the best combination of symptoms that are most predictive of active disease. The populations to be screened are varied. Patients in HIV care and treatment settings, HIV-positive mothers who are attending antenatal clinics, HIV-positive VCT clients, people attending STI clinics, clients in congregate situations such as the prisons, household context of people with open TB, and home-based care clients. More recently, in Kenya, we have started home-based care VCT, and we want to incorporate intensified case finding for TB in that subpopulation as well. Now, just want to show you some of the HIV care settings in Kenya. On the far left, this is an ART clinic. We estimate that we have 350 ART clinics. Nearly 300,000 clients are ART eligible. And at this moment in time, about 145 clients are on ART. We estimate that we have 2,100 PMTC clinics. And through these clinics, about 80,000 HIV-positive mothers attend at least one antenatal clinic annually. We have home-based care, VCT, and we have an actively expanding mobile VCT services. Now, we need to evaluate the TB screening tool that has been recommended to the National TB control program for various reasons. One is to identify the most sensitive combination of the elements that were listed previously. We need to evaluate the different combinations of elements against a gold standard, which is bacteriologically proven culture-positive specimens. Now, we also need to evaluate the performance of these tools in different populations and settings, and also whether the HIV status has a role in this. Now, we also plan in Kenya public health evaluations, whose primary objective would be to compare the outcomes in sites using the routine practice that the usual care with sites that will be using the enhanced intensified case-finding approach, with the following outcomes: the number of cases that were detected, time to diagnosis, time to completion of treatment, morbidity and mortality over a 12-month period. Now, in the enhanced screening group, data will be collected to determine the combination of screening elements that would be most predictive of TB, and secondly, to identify any barriers to rapid diagnosis and treatment of TB. Now, this public health evaluation will in part prepare Kenya's participation in a planned multi-center evaluation of the best approaches to TB screening and diagnosis in HIV care settings. Now, what else is Kenya doing to strengthen intensified case-finding activities? We are improving collaboration between TB and HIV programs. When collaborative TB-HIV activity started in Kenya, it was primarily driven by the TB program. But at this moment in time, in the context of intensified case-finding of TB, the HIV program is also taking ownership of this particular activity, and I think that this will go a long way to improve collaboration and implementation of collaborative activities. We will need to improve referral linkages to TB diagnostic and treatment services. We need to use simple, user-friendly TB screening tool. We are in the process of developing patient tracking and intensive case-finding monitoring tools. We are at the same time mobilizing resources to support staff training, commodities, and infrastructure. We face numerous challenges, some of which are we need different screening tools, given that we have a wide disparity of healthcare complexities. We need tools that will pick atypical manifestations of TB, particularly in the context of HIV disease. We need to settle when and how often we should be screening HIV-positive individuals for TB. Now, we need to give particular attention to specific needs of children, given the fact that the diagnosis of TB in children is a challenging one. We need to find out how best we can optimize the use of the available hands, given a chronic shortage of manpower and infrastructure. And obviously, intensified case finding increases responsibilities for this individual. So we need to work out strategies to improve in that aspect. In conclusion, intensified case finding for TB and HIV in HIV care setting is a key priority for Kenya. Kenya must obviously continue to promote implementation of collaborative TB-HIV activities as the best strategy to combat the two epidemics. Kenya, of course, recognizes the limitations and unanswered questions on intensified case-finding tools, that is, their specificity and sensitivity, and will use the current efforts to provide answers. I wish to acknowledge the Kenya HIV and TB programs for both political as well as technical leadership and policy. I wish to secondly acknowledge CDC through PEPA for technical and financial support. And lastly, I wish to acknowledge ICAP, Columbia University, for sharing their results on intensified case finding. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Joseph. Are there any questions from the audience? Joseph, I have a question. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the role of NASCOP, or the National AIDS Program, in Kenya in implementing intensified case finding and the challenges that you see with that.
Thank you very much. So since the entry point for intensified TB screening is the client with HIV, I think it's very, very important that NASCOP, the National AIDS Control Program, takes leadership role in this. When we had a stakeholders meeting in May, I'm glad to say that the preliminary draft intensified case finding guidelines and intensified case finding tools and TB screening tools were presented not by the TB program but by the HIV program. So I think that with time, both the TB and the HIV programs, both of which were previously housed under the National AIDS Control Program, will play an important role in taking leadership and ownership of integrated TB-HIV activities. And I think that this is an important improvement. Previously, we had a situation where collaborative TB-HIV activities was primarily driven by the TB program, but I think that this increasing recognition that both the HIV and the TB programs require each other in this process is important for Kenya.
Thank you very much. Okay, thanks, Joseph, and I think we'll move to the next speaker. Thank you. So our final speaker for this session is Dr. Michelle Gasana, who's the program manager of the TB program in Rwanda, looking at intensified TB case finding in care and treatment services in Rwanda. The talk will be given in French, but the slides are in English. There are headsets as needed in the back. Thank you. Michelle.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Je tiens d'abord à remercier les organisateurs pour nous avoir invités à partager sur ce qui se fait sur la tuberculose au Rwanda. Et je vais vous présenter les résultats préliminaires de la mise en œuvre de la politique sur le screening de la tuberculose chez les personnes vivant avec le VIH. Dans les centres qui donnent les ARV. Un peu de background, le Rwanda est un pays qui a 9 millions d'habitants, 83% de la population se trouve dans le milieu rural, 60% de la population vit en dessous du seuil de la pauvreté. Nous avons le taux de prévalence du VIH à peu près à 3,1%. On estime qu'à peu près 193 000 adultes vivent avec le VIH et les services qui sont les personnes qui sont dans les services qui donnent les soins VIH sont à peu près à 100 000 et 43 000 sont sous ARV. Et actuellement, nous avons 38% de malades tuberculeux qui sont co-infectés. Juste pour vous montrer le temps de détection au Rwanda, et ce que vous allez remarquer, c'est que d'une façon générale, pour les cas de TPM, donc de tuberculose pulmonaire microscopie positive, les cas restent stationnaires, mais en ce qui concerne les résultats de traitement, la situation s'améliore. C'est le même graphique, mais ici alors, cela vous montre que quand on voit d'une façon absolue, les cas de tuberculose augmentent, mais quand on voit les cas de TPM, ça reste stationnaire. Probablement aussi, ça se comprend dans un contexte à VIH. Donc ici, on aura beaucoup plus les cas de TPM d'extrait pulmonaire. Pourquoi le Rwanda a accepté de mettre sur pied une politique beaucoup plus le screening de la tuberculose? Ici, je vous montre les raisons qui ont motivé cette justification. La première chose, je crois que nous savons que le VIH et la tuberculose sont étroitement liés. Partant de là, donc, c'est tout à fait normal qu'on puisse réfléchir dans ce sens. La deuxième raison, c'est que les personnes qui vivent avec le VIH ont un risque beaucoup plus élevé de développer la tuberculose. Et nous savons aussi que la tuberculose reste la cause majeure de décès chez ces personnes qui sont infectées par le VIH. L'autre raison qui a motivé, je crois que en faisant ce que j'appellerais entre guillemets ce dépistage qui est en soi actif, cela d'abord peut nous aider pour détecter beaucoup plus ce malade. Partant de là, alors ça va augmenter notre taux de dépistage et aussi ça va diminuer la morbidité, la mortalité. Et nous savons aussi que la tuberculose se voit dans toutes les phases pour les personnes vivant avec le VIH. Je crois que c'est une raison de plus. La dernière raison qui est aussi fondamentale, c'est que même actuellement, si nous savons le bien fondé des ARV sur l'ensemble de les ARV sur le développement de la maladie de la tuberculose, mais nous savons aussi que le risque est beaucoup plus grand si nous devons comparer par rapport, donc si nous devons comparer le risque par rapport à la population non infectée par le VIH. Le risque est toujours grand. C'est pour cela que le pays a adopté donc cette politique, donc de faire le screening beaucoup plus de la tuberculose chez les personnes vivant avec le VIH. Qu'est-ce qui a été fait? C'est qu'on a fait, il y a eu un workshop qui devait regrouper tous les partenaires qui étaient impliqués, et ces partenaires regroupaient le programme tuberculose, le programme VIH, le programme et d'autres partenaires tant nationaux qu'internationaux. Et on a discuté, et c'est sur base de cette discussion que réellement nous avons donné les grandes orientations pour donc cette intégration entre la tuberculose, donc pour la tuberculose et le VIH. Et la politique a été adoptée la même année, donc en 2005, et aussi la politique a été disséminée. Partant aussi, c'est à ce moment-là que même on a mis sur pied un groupe de travail tuberculose VIH qui devait beaucoup plus donner les grandes orientations et leur suivi. La première chose qui a été faite par après, donc il fallait d'abord voir les guidelines et les outils aussi qui devaient être utilisés. Et c'est ainsi que dans le manuel technique qui est utilisé par le programme tuberculose, il y avait un chapitre spécifique pour ces activités tuberculose VIH. Nous avons mis sur pied aussi les modules de formation qui devaient regrouper donc les activités tuberculose VIH, et aussi les outils qui sont utilisés devaient aussi tenir compte de ces deux éléments, donc de ces deux pathologies, et le système aussi de monitoring et d'évaluation a été donc mis sur pied, et aussi tous les matériels relatifs donc à la mobilisation aussi ont été confectionnés et donc distribués. Ici, c'est juste pour vous montrer les différents outils qui ont été développés. En ce qui concerne la politique nationale pour l'intensification donc de la tuberculose, donc du dépistage de la tuberculose chez les PVV, ici, nous partons de certains principes donc, qui sont dans la politique. C'est que tous les malades, beaucoup plus qui fréquentent les services ARV, doivent faire le screening beaucoup plus au début, quand ils sont enrôlés, et puis 6 mois après. Et le deuxième élément, c'est que les personnes vivant avec le VIH qui ont été suspectées alors doivent aussi être évaluées selon les algorithmes et les directives du programme tuberculose. Autre chose aussi, c'est qu'on devait aussi tenir compte des cas de contact, c'est quelque chose d'important, et de les incorporer dans le programme. Alors, pour cela, on a développé un questionnaire qui regroupe à peu près 5 symptômes, peut-être je vais en parler pas après. Donc, 5 symptômes dont on devait tenir compte. Et ce questionnaire, donc, devait être facile à être utilisé. Et je crois souligner ici que beaucoup plus on insistait avec ce questionnaire, beaucoup plus sur la sensibilité, que la spécificité. Et bien sûr, peut-être, je vais le dire après, quand on va voir des résultats, c'est que ce questionnaire aussi doit être évalué, parce qu'avec ces résultats, je crois qu'il faut l'évaluer dans le plus bref délai. Autre chose aussi, c'est que le malade qui avait le screening positif devait être considéré comme suspect, et à ce moment-là, on devait tenir compte de toutes ces guidelines qui sont utilisées pour effectivement voir si ils ont la tuberculose. Et alors, maintenant, je vais vous présenter quelques données depuis qu'on a commencé, où en sommes-nous. Ici, c'est pour vous montrer ce questionnaire. Ici, on a tenu compte de 5 questions. La première question était liée à la toux. Je crois que mes collègues qui sont ici en ont parlé. La durée de la toux, ici, nous avons considéré une toux qui était supérieure à 3 semaines. Ici, nous avons parlé de les sueurs nocturnes. Nous avons parlé aussi de la perte de poids, donc l'amaigrissement. Et le quatrième, c'était une fièvre en long cours, au moins une fièvre qui dépassait les 3 semaines. Et le cinquième élément, c'était le problème de contact. Si on est en contact avec un tuberculeux, donc à ce moment-là, ça revenait aussi. Donc, c'était un des signes. Alors, si on était positif à une de ces questions, à ce moment-là, donc, on devient automatiquement, donc, le screening est positif. Et à ce moment-là, donc, il faut commencer tout l'algorithme, donc, comment ça doit se faire. Et c'est ainsi que, à droite, vous avez le protocole maintenant opérationnel. Quand on devient positif, maintenant, qu'est-ce qui doit être fait? Alors, ici, je vous présente quelques données pour les sites qui ont été retenus. Au départ, donc, en 2006, on avait à peu près 20 centres qui ont été, donc, qui ont commencé ce processus, donc ce programme, 20 centres ARV. Et quand nous considérons en 2006 les malades qui ont été enrôlés, donc ici c'est les nouveaux enrôlés, ils étaient à peu près à 5839 pour 20 centres. Donc ici, ce qui est intéressant, c'est de remarquer que les malades qui ont eu le screening par rapport à tout malade enrôlé, on a eu à peu près 83%. Les malades qui ont eu, donc, qui ont fait le screening. Mais alors, ici, on a eu 27% des malades qui ont eu un screening positif. Ici, les 27% représentent l'ensemble de tout ce qu'il y avait le screening. Donc, il ne faut pas le considérer par rapport à l'ensemble de tout ce qui était enrôlé. Et c'est la même chose aussi. Les malades aussi qui ont commencé donc le traitement, c'était à peu près donc 8% par rapport donc à l'ensemble qui avait le screening positif. À ce moment, on dirait que c'était presque 100%. Donc, à ce moment-là, donc, c'était les résultats pour 2006. Pour 2007, on vous a présenté les données du premier semestre, donc le premier et le deuxième trimestre. C'est la même chose aussi. Donc, ici, nous avons eu à peu près 32 centres qui donnent les ARV, qui ont fait ce screening. Cette année, nous sommes à 88% pour le premier semestre qui ont eu le screening. Et le screening positif, c'était 25%. Et les cas positifs étaient à 5%. Ici, peut-être, je n'avais pas souligné, c'est que ici, les outils qui ont été développés se trouvent en grande partie, donc se trouvent dans les deux programmes. Donc ici, au niveau du programme tuberculose et aussi au niveau du programme là où il y a des ARV, c'est là où c'est questionné beaucoup et beaucoup plus développé. Alors, j'ai dit que dans la politique, il faudrait aussi tenir compte pour le suivi aussi des malades ARV. Et c'est ainsi que quand on voit ce tableau, ça nous montre que réellement, donc, le screening, ici, on parle donc, ici au 31, donc 6 mois après, donc au 31 décembre, on avait à peu près 10 000 qui étaient donc dans le programme. Et ce qu'on remarque, c'est que quand même, à peu près, c'est seulement presque la moitié donc, qui suivait, donc qui avait été, où on avait fait le screening. Je crois que ça, c'est un aspect beaucoup plus important. Bien sûr, ce qu'on va voir, c'est que cette année, quand on considère à la fin du mois de juillet, la situation s'est améliorée, mais le problème reste toujours. Aussi, c'est pour montrer que donc, cette amélioration peut dépendre des centres par rapport à un autre. Qu'est-ce qu'on peut maintenant retenir avec les données? Je crois que c'est un aspect beaucoup plus important. Si nous considérons, par exemple, les malades qui ont été enrôlés pendant cette année, on a eu à peu près dans les 4 000. Mais alors, si je crois que ça, c'est le nœud du problème. Quand on voit les malades réellement qui ont eu donc la tuberculose et qui ont commencé le traitement, c'est 65. Je crois que le chiffre est assez très bas. Et je crois que aussi, peut-être je vais en parler tout à l'heure quand je vais parler des problèmes qu'on rencontre et même peut-être la limite, peut-être même de cette approche. Et aussi, ici, si on considère donc les malades qui ont commencé le traitement, par l'ensemble, à tous les malades qui ont été enrôlés donc dans le service, vous voyez que nous sommes à peu près 1,5%. Ce que je disais que le chiffre est assez bas. Alors, maintenant, quels sont les challenges que nous rencontrons et puis aussi les limites? C'est que, d'une façon générale, quand on voit les résultats qu'on obtient avec cette approche, ce n'est pas beaucoup de choses. Mais ce qui est bon, peut-être vous pouvez vous poser la question, quelles sont maintenant les raisons, qu'est-ce que nous semblons, que nous avons découvert au niveau du programme, c'est que, d'une façon générale, beaucoup plus pour la phase post-screening dans le cadre des suivis, on sent que maintenant, ce n'est pas devenu encore une bonne approche, bien donc au niveau des services. Il y a aussi des raisons, parce que ici, beaucoup plus on donnait beaucoup plus de 6 mois, parce que c'est la période où beaucoup plus les malades dans le service ARV viennent faire leur CD4 pour voir l'évolution. Donc, à ce moment-là, on remarque qu'il y a certains malades qui manquent, qui ne viennent pas. Il y a d'autres, par exemple, d'autres prestataires qui ne demandent pas peut-être le screening. Ça, ce sont des raisons qu'on remarque beaucoup plus. Autre chose aussi, donc, c'est que le processus de diagnostic pour confirmer et exclure le diagnostic de la tuberculose ne suit pas donc les normes donc, qu'on a données, les normes nationales. Mais je crois que le grand problème aussi qui se pose, c'est le troisième point. Le troisième point, donc, la capacité du diagnostic. Je crois que c'est un aspect beaucoup plus important pour les centres de santé et assez faible. Donc ici, il y a des fois le problème de capacité au niveau du laboratoire, il y a le problème des appareils de radio, il y a l'interprétation des radios, il y a les problèmes de tuberculose extrapulmonaire avec son diagnostic. Je crois que ce sont ces différents défis aussi qui sont réels, qui doivent être aussi abordés. L'autre problème, ce qu'on a pu voir, pourquoi on ne parvient pas à avoir beaucoup de chiffres donc, qui consistants, c'est qu'aussi le système de recording et reporting pose problème. C'est-à-dire ici, même si des fois les prestataires ont des données, mais des fois ce n'est pas consigné dans les dossiers. Donc, ce sont des problèmes auxquels donc, on est confronté. Donc, en conclusion, donc, c'est pour dire que quand on voit beaucoup plus pour les malades qui sont enrôlés pour la première fois au départ, c'est que cette approche est faisable. L'approche est faisable. Mais cette approche a besoin d'être soutenue. Cette approche, je crois qu'il faut tenir compte de toutes ces difficultés qu'on a rencontrées pour essayer d'améliorer. Je crois qu'en gros, j'ai fini et je vous remercie.
Thank Thank you, Dr. Gassane. Thank you, everybody. Kayla and I, although we are going a little bit beyond time, we are exercising the prerogative of being chair, and maybe we can take some more questions. Maybe all the speakers could join the stage, and also Dr. Gassane. And the first two questions, if they can be to Dr. Gassane, if possible, and we will take 5 questions. And also Dr. Kane will address the comment that was brought up earlier about his talk.
Thanks, Tom, for a great session. My question is really to everybody, but also for Dr. Gassane. And that is, I think we've seen a lot of really great evidence on how best to screen, what is the sensitivity and specificity of various approaches. But I'd sort of like to encourage all of the researchers and program people in the room to think about then what does this mean programmatically, because screening and identifying TB suspects is really just the first step. And these data haven't been presented here, but I do know that in many settings, that's only the first step, and then what happens is very few of those patients actually get put on tuberculosis treatment and have good outcomes. I think we saw some data from India to suggest that they did a good job following those cases up. So the first thing, and I would welcome thoughts on this, is how do we make sure that once TB suspects are identified, that they complete the full workup? And the second question, which was alluded to a little bit in some of the previous questions, is how to balance the burden. In some very low resource settings like Mozambique or Ethiopia, there's only one lab in the whole country that does culture. And do we really want to be using that lab to screen patients, or do we want to reserve it for MDR cases or other priorities in country?
Do you want to try to take the first stab?
Non, c'est vrai. Non, c'est vrai que ce qu'elle a posé, vraiment, c'est vraiment pertinent. Donc, je crois que peut-être ce qu'il faut tenir compte, c'est que les problèmes toujours de... Quand on voit au niveau de la sensibilité, beaucoup plus, moi je parlais beaucoup plus de spécificité, réellement donc le problème se pose. C'est vrai que peut-être c'est dessus de voir avec tous les partenaires qui sont ici ce qui peut être fait d'une façon générale. Au juste, ce qui peut être, quand on voit dans les contextes qui se posent, comment pouvons-nous améliorer, tenir compte de données peut-être que je viens de présenter pour voir dans l'ensemble comment on peut améliorer sur le plan national ou même ailleurs. Mais ce qui est vrai, c'est que je crois que la première chose qu'il faut tenir compte si réellement nous voulons améliorer notre système, c'est d'essayer de voir tous les problèmes qui ont été soulevés aussi, d'essayer de les répondre. Je crois que ça, c'est vraiment des aspects. Je ne sais pas si j'ai répondu à la question.
The room was packed until 10 minutes ago, but it was really packed. We hope to see a similar event in Mexico in July 2008, because it's there where it should happen. The question remains, maybe Dr. Gassane, if you can address, is do you see as a burden on the TB program to intensify case finding, and maybe how this between the TB and the HIV program can be taken forward.
Oui, je disais que c'est vrai que c'est faisable. C'est faisable, mais je trouve qu'aussi il y a des limites. Je crois que ça, c'est l'aspect le plus important. Je crois que quand nous considérons beaucoup plus le système dans lequel beaucoup de pays africains travaillent, si je considère les centres de santé, est-ce que nous avons vraiment la capacité de poser le diagnostic? Est-ce que nos infirmières, parce que beaucoup plus, vous savez que dans le contexte du VIH, nous aurons beaucoup plus les cas de microscopie négative et extra-pulmonaire. Est-ce que réellement ils sont capables de le faire? Je crois que ça, c'est une des questions. Est-ce que aussi, si nous devons parler d'autres éléments qui doivent nous aider pour améliorer le diagnostic, les problèmes de culture, est-ce que cela aussi se fait? Non, je crois qu'il y a beaucoup plus de problèmes opérationnels pour arriver à de bons résultats. Mais ce qui se passe, je crois que peut-être au niveau des centres de santé, si réellement ils peuvent seulement se limiter au niveau de la microscopie, je crois que là, c'est faisable. Mais si on va trop loin, il y a beaucoup de malades alors qu'ils vont nous échapper parce qu'ils n'auront pas peut-être, on ne va pas faire ce diagnostic. Je crois que ça, c'est quelque chose là qui existe. Et je crois que c'est peut-être les pays africains beaucoup plus, ils vont avoir ce genre de problème. Donc, quand on voit les moyens qui sont à notre disposition, quand on voit le personnel dont on dispose, quand on voit tous ces problèmes d'ordre organisationnel, je trouve que quand même, il y a encore des problèmes pour avoir de bons résultats.
Thank you.
I thought maybe we could address that same question to the rest of the panel and see the other responses from other program areas.
Address at least screening tools are being kind of evaluated, focusing in adults only. And yet, as the case in Kenya, I think we have an important redirection that, okay, fine, alongside the adults, the interests of the adults, we need to find out how best the same tools can be used in children. We don't have much experience with the use of screening algorithm in children, but I would probably ask of the members of the panel there whether they have had consideration for how these tools could be translated to kind of meet the needs of children.
Are there any other questions from the audience? Yes.
I mean, just a question and a comment. And the comment first, I'm Pren Naidu, by the way, from the University of Stellenbosch. I think in countries where your HIV epidemic is generalized, that we should remember that intensified case finding is not just the work of the TB program or the HIV program, but of general health services. And so the whole issue of accurate algorithms is really important. And I guess what I found quite confusing about the first two presentations was the idea that cough is a very poor has a very poor predictive value in the algorithm. Because presumably all of these clients, or chronic cough rather, or reported chronic cough to be more accurate, all of these clients have had a productive sputum, which has been used as the gold standard to measure the symptoms against. So I was just wondering whether any of the research programs are looking at the social research aspects around why people are not reporting cough, because clearly on the day that they were tested, they had productive sputum. And whether, in fact, you're making some comment around whether it's cough of a different duration or whether it's a more acute cough that's presenting as TB.
Ronnie, do you have a second question?
Yes. Ronnie Zachariah from MSF in Brussels. A great deal of the intensified case finding is actually going to take place in communities. And as you know, in sub-Saharan Africa, most of our community workers and volunteers who actually screen for TB are HIV positive. And I'd just like to hear comments on this, particularly with XDR-TB, how we should protect our own volunteers in the community. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Maybe we'll address those two questions first. Maybe, Kevin, since it's also related to the earlier question about cough.
Yeah, I think I'll try to address the question that was asked earlier as well. The point was made earlier, and I think it was a great point, that HIV really has changed the face of tuberculosis, and it's for that reason that I think it's important to start again and look, use the evidence to figure out which symptoms actually are predictive of TB instead of using the old symptoms that always were associated with TB prior to the impact of HIV. And I think that what the data have shown, both from our study, from Dr. Kimmerling's three separate populations that he has studied, from a study that was discussed from Zambia that was presented at the MSF symposium a couple of days ago, and also a couple of others, is that cough on its own just is not a sensitive marker for HIV infection or for TB disease in HIV-infected persons. And it's not to say that you should forget about cough. It's just to say that you need to take a more comprehensive approach and consider the fact that actually patients with fever and weight loss, in spite of the fact that they don't have cough, may very well have TB disease. We have not looked at the social aspects of, you know, whether these patients who are self-reporting having cough or not having cough are actually, you know, how accurate that is within their perspective. I would say, though, that even patients who are not coughing can produce sputum, which is sufficient to test, and I think that's one of the things we definitely found. We had many patients who clearly said that they had not had a cough. We asked the question, have you had a cough, period, at any time within the past month? And many patients said that they haven't even had a cough during that time. And through, you know, through coaching and direct observation of how to produce a sputum, most of them were able to produce a sputum which was adequate to use for smear and culture.
In most of the places, including ours, the first question asked when screening for tuberculosis is cough. And if we continue doing that, you know, we would have missed, as I suggested, 56% of cases who are actually tuberculosis cases. So what we recommend is cough alone is not enough. We have to add other symptoms, which we found, for example, fever, wet loss, and now it's sweating. With the four of these symptoms, we increase the sensitivity very much. So we shouldn't rely, that's our recommendation, on cough alone, as we did before for non-HIV positive patients. That's our recommendation.
Actually, I'd like to address the question about engaging the community. I think it's actually an important point, especially in settings where actually the HIV epidemic is not so generalized, where it's more concentrated and it's more difficult to access populations which have high HIV prevalence. So as an example, the Revised National TB Control Program of India has collaborated with networks of NGOs providing care and services to HIV-infected persons and also high-risk populations as part of targeted interventions, such as sex workers or truckers, where the prevalence of HIV is substantially higher than the general population. And these same basic, simple, intensified case-finding activities, that is, symptom screening, have been provided to these outreach workers, numbering in the tens of thousands, as part of a basic training in package with some training on how to be an effective community DOTS provider so that those who are identified after their referral to an appropriate diagnostic facility can then be provided appropriate TB treatment in a setting where they're likely to complete it. So I agree with you, it's fully critical to engage the community, and there are large networks that can be leveraged to access and deliver these services to those populations for whom it's appropriate.
Okay, well, I think we're being asked to close up. So thank you for staying late, and thank you for being here. I think we – hold on. Okay. Just a few remarks. I think that a number of really important issues came out in this session in terms of what we just talked about, the cough and the issue of the right algorithm, issues of looking at screening and intensified case finding among HIV negative populations, looking at the example of India as a really important way of case finding, looking at issues of NTM and identification and the increasing use of liquid culture and how that will impact case finding, frequency of screening, the yield of screening in different settings with different algorithms. An important point that wasn't discussed at great length but needs to be is infection control, of course, in all these settings where TB screening is being done, and the important engagement of the HIV program in all of these activities, as Fabio earlier said. So I think we saw some very exciting comprehensive evaluations, and I think the push to do more screening, whatever the algorithm, is really critical right now in TB control. I think we're on our way to do that. Thank you for being here this afternoon.